everyone. My name is Vicky here at the Talking Information Center, and today is Monday, April 6th, and I'll be reading today's Patriot Ledger. Thank you for listening. The first article today is titled, Private Credit Sector Under Stress, written by Vidya Raghunathan of Reuters. London. Some investors think private credit is a tempest in a teapot. Others think it is about to spark a new financial crisis. Depending on the time horizon, both sets of views about the esoteric sector may be right. Signs of trouble in the obscure world of private lending, which had soared in popularity with companies looking for quick, bespoke debt and investors seeking high returns, have been brewing since the middle of 2025. The pace at which investors are demanding money back from some of the private credit funds known as business development companies, or BDCs, has accelerated this year on worries about competition, falling returns, and fears that artificial intelligence will upend software businesses financed by them. Blue Owl Capital was the latest BDC to report it recently received a historic level of redemption requests and was limiting withdrawals, which it is allowed to do. Other big players such as Ares Management, Apollo Global, Blackstone, KKR, and private credit arms of banks such as Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan, and Goldman Sachs have also capped redemptions. Most have signaled the redemptions showed the private credit industry was going through a period of recalibration rather than a crisis. Still, other signs of stress have emerged. BDCs are getting hit with higher rates on their bank borrowings, even as the historically high double-digit returns they make on private lending shrink. You're going to have credit cycles. You're going to have losses. You're going to have some markdowns. I mean, they're not lending at 5% for a reason, right? Said John Giordano, managing director of New York-based Seaport Global Holdings. Giordano doesn't believe risks are systemic, pointing to how BDCs have low leverage, hold senior debt, or are involved through equity holdings in the management of their companies. He also cited how well capitalized the banking sector is. AI risks. Private lending bloomed after the 2008 financial crisis, becoming the alternative to bank finance for private equity firms seeking to acquire medium-sized businesses via long-term loans with simpler covenants and high returns. Data on exact exposures, valuations, and losses at BDCs remains sequestered, given they are private deals, but they collectively hold more than $500 trillion of private assets. The private credit industry, the Alternative Investment Management Association, estimates at $3.5 trillion, is big enough to be consequential for financial markets. Share prices of some of the publicly listed BDCs have fallen sharply this year, trading at a roughly 20% discount to their net asset values. Shares of U.S. software services firms, the sector most closely linked to private credit, have also fallen by a fifth this year. Rory Dowie, equity portfolio manager at Marlborough in London, said his firm has cut exposure to some of these asset managers and even shed holdings in Swiss private equity firm Partners Group, whose chair Stefan Meister said in March that default rates in private credit could double over the next few years owing to AI-driven economic disruption. Dowie says the symbiotic relationship in AI financing between public and private markets could result in a snowball effect. It's hard to say what's going to crack first, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy whereby you could get a bigger, more systemic issue occurring. Javier Corominas, director of the Global Macro Strategy at Oxford Economics, recently said the market is already in the early stages of a rolling crisis in private credit, based on estimates that 25 to 35% of these portfolios are subject to AI disruption risk. We are still at the beginning of discovering the issues, and it might not happen tomorrow. It might happen in 3 months or 6 months, said London-based Alberto Gallo, chief investment officer at Andromeda Capital Management. You have this box where you have 100 companies, but you know that 10 of them are dead cats. Until you open the box, they are still alive. That's basically what they have created. Are insurers left with the bag? Corominas said total bank lending to BDCs is modest and manageable, but the bigger worry is private credit holdings among U.S. life and annuity insurers. These holdings have more than doubled over the past decade. Private credit accounts for around 35% of total U.S. insurer investments, close to a quarter of U.K. of insurer assets, he said. More worryingly, insurers affiliated with private equity firms hold an estimated $1 trillion in assets acquired through those relationships, and the exposure to the private credit losses will fall disproportionately on U.S. pension funds and retail savers who have purchased life annuities from the insurers, he said. Should private credit losses erode insurer solvency, the resulting contagion would not resemble the bank run dynamics of 2008, but would instead manifest as a slow, grinding erosion of retirement security, harder to detect in real time and significantly more difficult to reverse, Corominas wrote. Andromeda's Gallo said he wouldn't dismiss the private credit woes as non-systemic risk simply by comparing it with the 2008 subprime crisis, which was driven by extended housing leverage through what was termed collateralized debt obligations. This is a different animal with different contagion channels, he said, referring to how leverage is pumped up in later stages in private credit by insurers. In the subprime crisis, contagion was through banks, and there was proper valuation of assets. But this time it is through insurance companies with no mark-to-market and more default risk, he said. Regulators always fight the last crisis, and here you have the opposite, the mirror image of the last crisis. The next article I'll be reading is titled, On Easter, Pope Urges Leaders to End Wars, written by Joshua McElwee. Vatican City. Pope Leo urged global leaders in his Easter message on April 5th to end the conflicts raging across the world and abandon any schemes for power, conquest, or domination. The Pope, who has emerged as an outspoken critic of the Iran war, lamented in a special message to the thousands gathered in St. Peter's Square that people are, quote, growing accustomed to violence, resigning ourselves to it, and becoming indifferent, unquote. Let those who have weapons lay them down, the first U.S. Pope said. Let those who have the power to unleash wars choose peace. Leo did not mention any specific conflicts in the message, known as the Urbi et Orbi, to the city and the world, blessing. It was unusually brief and direct. The Pope said that the story of Easter, when the Bible says Jesus rose from the dead 3 days after not resisting his execution by crucifixion, shows that Christ was entirely nonviolent. On this day of celebration, let us abandon every desire for conflict, domination, and power, and implore the Lord to grant his peace to a world ravaged by wars, Leo said. Leo is known for choosing his words carefully and has been forcefully decrying the world's violent conflicts in recent weeks and ramping up his criticism of the Iran war. In a sermon for the Easter Vigil on April 4th, he urged people not to feel numbed by the scope of the conflicts raging across the world, but to work for peace. The Pope made a rare direct appeal to President Donald Trump on March 31, urging him to find an off-ramp to end the Iran war. On March 29, he said that God rejects the prayers of leaders who start wars and have hands full of blood. In his address from the balcony of St. Peter's Basilica on April 5th, to the square below, decorated with thousands of brightly colored flowers for the holiday, Leo offered brief Easter greetings in 10 languages, including Latin, Arabic, and Chinese. The Pope also announced he would return to the Basilica on April 11 to host a prayer vigil for peace. Our next article is going to be about the Artemis II and its photos profoundly affects crew. Image gives astronauts a new perspective on life. Written by Janine Santucci. As the four astronauts on the 10-day Artemis II mission around the moon got their first clear glimpse of Earth, the view of their home planet in the distance stopped them in their tracks. They captured a remarkable photo of Earth from the first crewed moon mission in 50 years. The photo, taken by Commander Reid Wiseman on April 2nd from the Orion's spacecraft's window, showed Earth from tens of thousands of miles away. It captured the spectacular blues and browns of the planet, and even caught two auroras lighting up the atmosphere. The image has dazzled those back on Earth who are following the Artemis II mission and may never get the chance to see our home planet from space for themselves. But the view has also had a profound impact on the crew, the first humans to leave Earth's orbit since 1972. There was a moment about an hour ago where Mission Control Houston reoriented our spacecraft as the sun was setting behind the Earth. And I don't know what we all expected to see in that moment, Wiseman told reporters during a question and answer session from space on April 2nd, describing all the detail the crew could see of Earth. It was the most spectacular moment, and it paused all four of us in our tracks. Astronauts in the past have gotten to see glimpses of auroras, lightning strikes, and metropolitan areas lit up as evidence of human life. Seeing Earth from above has had such a transformative influence on astronauts that there is an entire psychological phenomenon to describe it, called the overview effect. It can change an astronaut's entire perspective on Earth and life itself. The astronauts will also get to see parts of the moon that nobody has ever laid eyes on before, the far side not viewable from Earth. That will happen during a roughly 6-hour window on April 6, today, when the Sun, Moon, and the Orion spacecraft will be aligned just the right way so the astronauts can see about 20% of the far side of the moon lit by the sun, NASA said. Looking back at Earth. The Artemis II crew members described a breathtaking view of Earth and details of what they were seeing. Mission specialist Christina Cox said that from space, they can see the coastline of continents, rivers, thunderclouds, and the South Pole lit up, NPR reported. The photo captured by Wiseman shows auroras on the poles lit up in green. there's nothing that prepares you for the breathtaking aspect of seeing your home planet both lit up bright as day and also the moon glow on it at night with the beautiful beam of the sunset, Cuck told reporters in a live stream from space. You could see the entire globe from pole to pole. You could see Africa, Europe, and if you looked really close, you could see the Northern Lights, Wiseman said. Astronauts for decades have tried to put into words the experience of seeing Earth from various missions. Alan Shepard was the first American to view Earth from space in 1961 from the Freedom 7 Mercury capsule during a 15-minute suborbital flight. If somebody'd said before the flight, "Are you going to get carried away looking at the Earth from the moon?" I would have said, "No, no way," Shepard said after walking on the moon during the Apollo 14 mission in 1971. "But yet when I first look back at the Earth standing on the moon, I cried." The International Space Station has a good view of Earth from its seven-windowed cupola module. Former NASA astronaut Nicole Stott said she looked for her home state of Florida during her first trip to the ISS in 2009. "I wanted to go to the window and see it, and then realize somewhere down the line that I wasn't looking at Florida the same way anymore," she said. "I wanted to see Florida, but Florida had just become this special part of home, which is Earth. We're all Earthlings." The overview effect. The life-altering effects of viewing Earth from space have garnered psychological research, and in 1987 were dubbed the overview effect by space philosopher and author Frank White, who first considered the phenomenon while on a cross-country flight and decided to start interviewing astronauts. One of the most common experiences they shared was seeing the reality that there are no borders or boundaries separating people, he said. "And what the astronauts were telling me was, I knew before I went into orbit or went to the moon that there weren't any little dotted lines. But it's knowing intellectually versus experiencing it," White said on a NASA podcast in 2019. A common conclusion astronauts made from their observations, White said, "We are really all in this together. Our fate is bound up with people that we may think are really different from them. But we have different religions, we may have different politics, but ultimately we are connected, totally connected." It's a difficult concept to convey, White said, because all you have is words. To fully understand, you need to see it for yourself, he said. Cuck described the overview effect from the International Space Station this way in a NASA publication from November of 2025. "The overview effect is when you're looking through the cupola and you see the Earth as it exists with the whole universe in the background. You see the thin blue line of the atmosphere, and then, when you're on the dark side of the Earth, you actually see this very thin green line that shows you where the atmosphere is. What you realize is every single person that you know is sustained and inside of that green line, and everything else outside of it is completely inhospitable. You don't see borders. You don't see religious lines. You don't see political boundaries. All you see is Earth, and you see that we are way more alike than we are different. Are you going to try to live your life a little differently? Are you going to really choose to be a member of this community of Earth?" Artemis II pilot Victor Glover previously said. On April 2nd, when asked about division back on Earth, Glover said, "Trust us. You look amazing. You look beautiful. And from up here, you also look like one thing. Homo sapiens, all of us, no matter where you're from or what you look like, we are all one people." The next article today, Australia plays hardball on social media. Other nations consider enacting bans for kids, by Byron Kay of Reuters. Sydney. Since Australia banned children from using social media in December 2025, lawmakers from Spain to Malaysia have expressed interest in following suit, while U.S. courts have found tech firms negligent toward young users. The global spotlight on the first such ban on people under 16 using popular apps appears to have encouraged Prime Minister Anthony Albanese's government to recently ramp up enforcement of what it was touting as successful cooperation with the industry 2 months ago, tech policy experts say. In getting more aggressive with apps such as Instagram and TikTok, Albanese's center-left government is pleased with the overseas interest. At least 8 countries have said they want similar curbs. But keen to counter the news that many teens are still scrolling on their phones, experts say. The whole world's watching. The whole world's watching Australia in this experiment, and therefore it looks like weak government to back down or pretend that the failures and reasonable efforts aren't happening, said Janine Patterson, co-founder of the Center for Artificial Intelligence and Digital Ethics, who regularly advises the government on tech policy. A spokesperson for Communications Minister Anika Wells said she had not toughened her stance due to global attention, declining to comment further. A month after the ban took effect, the government reported in mid-January that social media platforms had deactivated 4.7 million suspected underage accounts, prompting industry participants to expect a grace period of up to a year on enforcement of the ban. The British and Canadian governments and some U.S. lawmakers have sounded out the Australian authorities on the social media ban, a policy overwhelmingly backed by parents but opposed by the multi-trillion dollar industry that must comply with it. Those signs of progress, however, have been undermined by a series of headlines about minors staying on social media. On March 31, the government said it was investigating Meta's Instagram and Facebook, TikTok, Alphabet's YouTube and Snapchat for possible breaches of the law, gathering evidence for possible legal action. The e-safety regulator had previously said it would only take enforcement action in cases of systemic non-compliance. In its first comprehensive compliance report, the regulator said nearly one-third of parents reported their under-16 child still had at least one social media account. Among those, two-thirds said the platform had not asked the child's age. The government is quite heartened, generally, by the number of other jurisdictions that are looking at imposing restrictions on the under-16s globally, said Angela Flannery, a former general counsel for the government's communications department, who now advises the private sector. But given the disheartening March 31 report on compliance, Flannery said, they probably want to be seen to be taking action to keep encouraging other jurisdictions to enforce or to enact similar bans. Meta and Snap said they were committed to complying with the ban. TikTok declined to comment, and Alphabet did not respond to a request for comment on the government action. Meta and Google lose in U.S. courts. The e-safety report said complaints about cyberbullying and image-based abuse, problems the government said the ban would fix, were unchanged, while parents reported being unable to notify platforms that their underage children still had accounts. Minors who failed an age test were being prompted to repeat the test until they passed, the regulator said. The ban requires platforms to take reasonable steps to keep under 16s from having an account or face fines of up to $34 million. Wells said the problem was not parents or kids failing to comply, but big tech undermining the government's policy. Also likely emboldening Australia to go after platforms, say people familiar with the ban's rollout, were a recent U.S. trial verdict ordering Meta to pay $375 million in penalties for safety lapses that allowed child exploitation on Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp, and another decision finding Meta and Google negligent for designing social media platforms that are harmful to young people. The court cases in New Mexico and California have helped the court of public opinion, said Julian Sefton Green, a professor of new media at Deakin University, who is advising the commissioner's two-year study on the ban's impact. Their jury decisions that social media is liable for the well-being of young people. So I think the government's going to take heart from that. Rob Nichols, a researcher of regulation at the University of Sydney, said the lawsuits may prompt platform redesigns that comply with the Australian ban by focusing on protecting minors. The effect of that decision change will be to reduce access for under 16s, he said. If you've got to do it to avoid litigation in the States, you may as well do the same thing around the world. The last article today is a Dear Abby column by Abigail Van Buren. Friends are unaware of my silent suffering. Dear Abby, I have a neurological disorder and can no longer keep up with my friends who used to be my friends. I don't explain the problems I have and why I can't do the things I used to do unless they ask. I still drive, but I have trouble walking. I have a wonderful husband who helps me all the time. I'm lucky I can do what I do, but I'm very limited. I don't know how to explain it to people who look at me like I'm making it up. Abby, I have polyneuropathy and have had 7 back surgeries. I have arthritis in all my joints. I live in constant pain, but it doesn't look like I do. How do I explain my disability? I'm tired of being at home and not getting phone calls anymore. How do I tell them there are still things I can do? Dear Down, by not discussing your problem, you have contributed to the isolation you are feeling. Your friends may think you are avoiding them because you don't want to be with them. You don't have to make any grand announcements, but you should have a frank talk with your closest friends about what your challenges are. Real friends make an effort to accommodate you if you let them know you need them in your life. Once you start talking, the word will get around. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Patriot Ledger today, Monday, April 6th. Take care, and thank you.